A laundromat there, on Metropolitan and Driggs. I remember getting my stuff out of the trunk, and there was just heroin needles all over the ground and little baggies of drugs. It was totally nuts. Tunde Edebimpe. I came for school. The third year, I was asked to leave, which is a nice way of saying you're failing out. It was a combination of my being a nonverbal hyper-introvert, plus being in film school with a bunch of 18-year-olds with no stories to tell, but wearing a baseball cap and sporting a beard thinking they were Steven Spielberg or George Lucas. It was annoying. Then I found animation. Basically, I was asked to leave because I spent more time in my basement in Williamsburg than I did in class. Jaleel Bunton. We grew up in Kentucky, and Chicago was the next biggest metropolis. There were a lot of big indie scenes in Chicago, but the music scene there wasn't mine. It wasn't what I needed. When you're playing in a Midwestern town, there's really only one alt culture. It's like, okay, punk rock, hippie, disco, rave, pop. I liked that about the Midwest. It's less judgmental. But the music wasn't in my strike zone. The music that I was into was a little more heavily influenced by black culture. And I just knew I wasn't going to find it in the Midwest. I did think I'd find it in New York. And I was right about that. Tunde Edebimpe. I wasn't worried about school. It felt like my education was just being in New York. I met so many really great artists and people who came at the same time I did for the same reason. The second month that I moved to New York, I was walking around the East Village, and I see this older balding man with a big beard coming toward me. I'm like, why does that guy look so familiar? And it's Allen Ginsberg. I'm like, oh my God. You're Allen Ginsberg. And he gives me this look, the I'm going to the deli man, so what look. I learned to stop saying that. I had fire engine red hair, an army jacket, and rimmed glasses. I remember going home to Pittsburgh and having my mom just be like, what is wrong with you? I was like, this look is going to bring forth exactly the type of person I want to meet, and make the exact kind of person I want to go away, go away. Dave Siddick. I had $165 when I got to New York. My brother was like, you might want to do something about that. Tunde Edebimpe. Dave moved into this loft I was living in. His brother Jason was one of my roommates. It was kind of a rotating cast of characters. We had up to 8 roommates at any given time, so Dave moved in, but I didn't see him for a while. Dave Siddick. We lived on South First and Havemeyer, above this fish market. It smelled unreal, but our rent was like $450 a month. The El Cafe had just opened, the wine store, coffee shop. Osnott's Dish opened. That was the neighborhood. I started painting immediately. I was selling paintings in the street, and that's how I became friends with Tunde. He said to me, you have no clothes and no furniture, but you have paint and drum machines? I was like, yeah, that's kind of the vibe. Tunde Edebimpe. We just found pictures of that place recently, and my room is essentially a big mess of books and paints and just crap all over the floor. Shit that I drag in from the streets and make into stuff. I was walking to the bathroom one day, and the door in Dave's room was open. I see a mattress with a bunch of paints on it, a desk with a bunch of cassette tapes, tons of empty cigarette boxes and cartons. I thought, I'll be friends with this kid. Dave Siddick. Karen referred to our old loft as the sandbox because she could come to our house and there was like paint, paper, and silk screening stuff everywhere. And it was just me and Tunde and my brother making whatever the fuck we wanted with whatever medium we wanted. Playing in the sandbox. Tunde Edebimpe. We weren't paying anyone to be there, and if you'd seen it, you'd know why. I mean, there was plywood on the windows. We didn't have windows for a really long time. We'd spend most of the night painting, and then go out in the morning and sell stuff. Dave Siddick. I mostly set up on the corner of West Broadway in Spring. At the time, there was this older woman who was a hot dog vendor, and that was her corner. I just became friends with her by default, because I would set up next to her. I ate a lot of hot dogs for that first year. Tunde Eribimpe. She was awesome. That was fun. Dave Siddick. She always looked out for me. All the art galleries would call the cops on an artist if they set up in the street. So when the cops would come, she would defend me. She'd scream, "He's not doing anything! Leave it alone!" Tunde Eribimpe. I was also working for this animation show called Celebrity Deathmatch. I was one of the first animators on that show. Dave Siddick. My stuff was, for a lack of better description, children's art with adult subject matter. Not porno shit, but just really bizarre, surrealist stuff. Tunde Eribimpe. It was hilarious. He made this enormous painting of a bullfighting ring and a matador with a bull in it. It was probably 6 feet by 4 feet, and he had done it on this weird fancy dining tabletop thing. But every face in the arena, he had cut out of a magazine and pasted it up, and there were like 200 or 300. To take the painting into town, he put eye socket screws in it, attached his guitar strap, and carried it into town on his back. It was Dave in this big circle getting onto the train. Dave Siddick. I'd always been making music. I was in bands when I was a teenager, but I didn't really want to be in front of people. So by this point, I was making experimental music on my own just for fun. It wasn't like I was going to produce other people. The only reason that I started producing was because of this band in Baltimore called Love Life. I love their band, and I was just too impatient for them to go into a studio and record with someone. So I just recorded them myself so that I could get the record faster. Tunde Eribimpe. The night Dave and I started making songs together, we ended up putting 6 of them on this disc called OK Calculator. We silk-screened covers and hid the CDs in furniture stores or bookstores. We had an email address on the back, so people actually started writing in being like, "I found this CD. What is this? What's going on? Who are you guys?" We left a stack of them at the Verb Cafe for people to take, and that was about it. I don't think it went any further than trying to make art and music together. Then Dave started producing with Yeah Yeah Yeahs. So he'd be gone a few months, and I'd just get back to what I was doing. Jaleel Bunton. Everyone in the band had been here for some time already. Everyone had done the time in the coffee shops, had done the time in the whatever other job. Everyone in the band has a grunt side. We grew up grunt people, did grunt work. We never really saw the people that didn't live in the world of "I work at some shitty coffee shop." Dave Siddick. When I was Yeah Yeah Yeah's tour manager, we talked about doing their record. So I rented a studio in the neighborhood called Headgear. That's where we did Fever to Tell.
Karen O. I can't even remember how he ended up producing our record. It just kind of happened. I remember him giving me a few burned CDs of stuff that he had worked on. I guess he was just a buddy, and we felt immediately like we were family with him. And we didn't know anyone else. That was probably one of the biggest reasons we worked with him, because we didn't know anyone else. Then, of course, he ended up being fucking really masterful.
Dave Siddick. After Fever to Tell, the Liars asked me to do their record. Because all these bands were doing it all analog, the Liars were like, "We want to do it all digital." I didn't know how to use Pro Tools, so I bought a Pro Tools system, and then I recorded me and Tunde making music. Just so I could learn how to use Pro Tools. The Young Liars EP is actually just me learning how to use Pro Tools. We had no intention of it coming out. Tunde and I weren't really a band. But we gave it to Karen and our friends, and then Karen gave it to Corey Rusk at Touch and Go Records, and then he was like, "I want to put this out." It was kind of an accident. Moby. For me, personally, musically, the most exciting thing to come out of that world was TV on the radio. Everything else was good, but good in a way that you expect it to be good. TV on the radio, especially that first album, was so much better than the sum of its parts. The sum of its parts were perfectly fine, but the synergistic sort of magic of that, and that amazing voice. And it was an introduction to soulful African-American elements with electronics in indie rock. Tunde Edebimpe. A friend of mine. We were once talking about how he realized that he was gay, and he basically said, I realized that I was going to bed with more men than women. That was how it was with TV on the radio. At some point, I had to admit it to myself. I was like, I've been in a band on tour for more time than I haven't. So I guess I'm in a band. Dave Siddick. After the Liars record, I just kept getting asked to do stuff. Gradually, I was painting less and doing more and more music. Tunde Edebimpe. The first TV on the radio shows, Dave would have a sampler, and I would be up there with just a loop pedal, singing and just making shit up. We would just mess around and improvise, taking themes from the audience. I remember I made a song called My Baby Looks Like Santa Claus in Red Drawers when someone suggested underwear as a theme. Dave Siddick. After Young Liars came out, we got asked to play more shows. Kip joined, and then it was me, Kip, and Tunde. Jaleel Bunton. I really liked the EP. I thought it was amazing. All the stuff that I was describing about music, everything that I was going for, it had. It was this electronic thing, but it wasn't overly electronic. It still felt organic and soulful, but also referenced in its omission or its inclusion. All of the other things that were cool that were going on in music, they were doing it better than I was doing it. It was a similar aesthetic, but they had pulled it off. Tunde Edebimpe. He'd seen a couple of the shows at Stinger. That's where we played every Wednesday and Saturday. Stinger is on Grand Street. It was just a saloon, but there was a sign behind the bar that said, get naked, you get a free shot. Oral sex, you get 3 free shots. Fuck on the bar, you get an open tab. And all those things happened. You'd see the sign and you'd think, this has got to be pretty hot. It's actually not hot when you're having a drink with a friend and you look behind you and there's a dick in someone's mouth. But so one day Dave and I were walking into the Verb, saw Jaleel coming up. We started talking and he said, yeah, I saw you guys, and you need me. The balls on this dude. Dave Siddick. I knew who Jaleel was because all of my friends know Jaleel. When we got asked to do real shows, we thought, we should get a real band. So I go to Jaleel, who's the best guitarist out of anyone I've ever met, hands down, and ask him to play drums. He was like, you know I don't play drums. And I said, that's perfect. It's exactly what we need. Jaleel Bunton. Yeah, we'd made this recording with me on drums, even though I don't really play drums, just for fun. Dave Siddick. And then we got Gerard, who's the other best guitarist we knew, to play bass and keys. Tunde Edebimpe. Maybe there's some Grimm's fairy tale where someone is walking through the forest and he's on a quest and he meets someone who turns something into stone. And he's like, join my quest. You will need this. It was totally like that. Like a series of people just saying, you need me, and us saying, you're right. Dave Siddick. What is TV on the radio? I mean, I don't even know. Honestly, I have no idea. It's just like a thing that doesn't work, but does. I look at us like a rubber band in the sense that when you're a kid and you have a rubber band on your wrist and you pull it and it snaps. You get that little sting. That sting is what happens when all of us finally get to the same thing. We pull it all different directions, pull away from each other, but it always ends up snapping back. And in that moment, something really authentic and true ends up happening.
Chapter 45. The Uncool Kids. Ed Drost. There was a Brooklyn versus Manhattan element. I had more encounters and interactions with Yeah, TV on the Radio, and Liars than I did with The Strokes. The Strokes happened, and I was totally into it, but it felt separate. Chris Taylor. I loved The Strokes, and I really liked that first Interpol record. I listened to LCD Sound System. I really loved those bands. I just didn't see how any music that I might ever make would have anything to do with that scene.
just because I was so not rock-oriented.
Karen O, I didn't really peg Interpol or The Strokes as arty, whereas Liars and TV on the Radio were kind of nerdy but definitely arty. We related more and identified more with some of the artier bands. We weren't very arty, but we were arty enough.
Angus Andrew. Yeah, TV on the Radio. That was pretty much our group of friends. We didn't know The Strokes or Interpol. They were already big. But anyone from Brooklyn, we'd see them or play with them. It was a very tight community. Chris Taylor. It almost became kind of annoying. People were so damn friendly about it. You'd walk to the coffee shop and you'd have to stop and talk to a lot of people. It would take a really long time, just because you knew everyone in the neighborhood and everyone was so nice and would ask you about your band and how everything was going. It wasn't like a competitive thing, which is not very New York. It was nice. Angus Andrew. I mean, we were living in a loft with people from TV on the Radio and Yeah Yeah Yeahs, right at Bedford.
Eleanor Friedberger. I remember early on seeing Karen and her boyfriend from the Liars walking down Bedford with their arms around each other, and I just remember thinking, oh, they're so cool.
Angus Andrew. But apart from the physical reality of being in the same area at the same time, what connected us was not having a sense of a direction about what we all should be doing. There wasn't a sense of, you know, one of these bands is doing something that we all should be trying to do, so we gathered around that band. It felt like everybody had their own direction to go. We all felt quite different to each other, and that felt good. You could admire someone else's work, even though that's not the work that you yourself want to be doing. That was the big connection. There wasn't a through line of the sound. I'm sure in hindsight the words post-punk and art whatever come up, but it certainly didn't feel at all defined then. And maybe if you spoke to all the people in the grunge world, they would have said the same thing. But it didn't feel like we were all moving to Seattle to play one kind of music. It felt more random. Ed Drost. TV on the Radio, Chick Chick Chick, a lot of those bands were really playing what seemed retrospectively to be hyper-illegal shows in Brooklyn. Nick Offer. We went to this party at Mama's in the East Village, and all the food and drinks were free. It had, like, amazing DJs, and people were doing really whacked-out sets, and there were drugs around. It was the last time I heard of heroin being at a party. It felt very much like the last vestiges of the old New York. We were like, we should throw a party in Brooklyn like that. A party is a gift to the world. We had this huge space. So I called everyone in my phone book, whether I remembered who they were or not. That was the point. Ed Drost. There was this space called Happy Birthday Hideout. It was just a single staircase up, packed with 500 people. An insane fire hazard. People would take over entire floors. People would just donate their living spaces for one massive party where there would be a roof element and an inside element, and like a mix of different concerts. Angus Andrew. When I think about it visually, what I see is the Twisted Ones space. Those guys brought a lot of this together. Todd P. That was about a guy named John Fitz, who was the first person to do the kind of shows I do. The first person in the area to do the kinds of shows that I got associated with. Loft warehouse parties that were a little dangerous. He had an organization called Twisted Ones, and he basically did the punk rock shows. Angus Andrew. The visual aesthetic they represented with their posters and the shows that they put on ended up being really important. Todd P. Fitz did these shows at a couple of warehouse spaces, but a main one called Mighty Robot. Angus Andrew. Mighty Robot was really the epicenter for a lot of these bands, and a lot of the touring bands that came through there that also influenced us and were of the same mindset. Vito Roccaforte. Brooklyn was a really fertile area, but it hadn't been mined, planted, whatever fucking metaphor I'm going with here. Another person who was really important was Todd P., because he did all of this DIY stuff. Rob Sheffield. God bless that fucking man. He's so unsung, and he's done it for so long. Nobody who's actually accomplished so much has so little ego about it. It's the kind of thing where I'm in awe of him and what he's done, and usually when I see him, it's at some kind of show where he's absolutely breaking his back to make everything happen. And he's carrying amps, and he's carrying equipment, and he's moving things, and he's looking up at the sky to see if it's going to rain, to see if they need a tent. Dave Longstreth. Todd P. used to run a club back in Portland called 17 Nautical Miles. That was just a great, youthful, all-ages space where a lot of my friends' bands played. Todd knew me from that. Todd P. I'd been doing shows for Dave since he was at Yale and would come down all the time. His brother had been in a band that I'd booked in Oregon. Dave Longstreth. I remember thinking that I wasn't very interested in the New York scene as a social environment, but it seemed like every time I came down here and played for one of these Todd shows, it was often super interesting and confusing and eye-opening, and I met a lot of people. I was totally uninterested in Manhattan. I played a show there once, and there was one dude who was writing a text message, and I remember just being like, oh my God, how rude, how ridiculous. This is like Manhattan behavior. But Todd's shows were interesting. Andrew Van Weingarten. After I moved to New York, I went to Todd P. parties. I actually worked the door at 3 or 4 Todd P. parties, taking money. I liked how crazy the venues were. Dave Siddick. He was a promoter, and he was just putting on shows, finding venues that weren't even venues. Dave Longstreth. One of the first ones I played was on top of a fridge in the corner of this place, above the right bank in South Williamsburg.
Eleanor Friedberger. Brooklyn was just amazing.
Chris Taylor. When I first moved to Brooklyn, Chris Baer, who plays drums in our band, moved into the same loft as me. We built it together. We were in this band, and at that age when you really have the energy and ambition to do all of this, there's just things that you don't care about that allow you to be free and experimental and take big risks and live in a dirty place, and you don't give a shit. Rent was really cheap, $600 a month. Chris and I were vegetarians because it was cheaper. We cooked rice and beans so many nights. We priced it out. We knew the cost of the beans and the cost of the rice, and we bought the onions and were like, okay, cool. This whole food element of life is under $5. We can buy a Yingling, which was like $1.50, which was definitely a choice beer at that time, and that was enough. You find a cheap bike, so you don't even have to take the subway. That and some money for weed, that was your budget. That was all you needed. Dave Siddick. It was so cheap that you could afford to take risks and fail. If you failed at what you were doing, it didn't matter because you were in Williamsburg. If you failed in Manhattan, it was different.
Eleanor Friedberger. I rode my bike everywhere. I got all of these amazing jobs that were so easy and stupid. I would work these office jobs, then go out every night, and I could afford to pay my rent. Alex Wagner. I think of the Brooklyn bands as gentler, easier to digest. These are groups of people who have much more space and time to think and develop their sound. They're nerds. They're not doing blow with waitresses at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know? Karen O. I was in an Uber the other day, and the driver asked, "What do you do, blah, blah, blah?" I usually don't say much, but he was really grilling me for it, so I told him. And as we were driving, he pulls up this picture of us with me in the middle on his phone. He goes, "That guy on the right," meaning Nick, "he looks like he was born to be in a band. And that guy on the left," meaning Brian, "looks like he should be sitting in front of a computer." By the way, this was one of the more stylish photos of Brian I've ever seen, like a very rock and roll photo. And he still looks like he should be sitting in front of a computer. I mean, Dorkosaurus Rex.
Dave Siddick. What brought Gerard, Jaleel, Kip, Tunde, and I together was the fact that we're all nerds. We read a lot. Naomi Klein. I remember Shock Doctrine made its way around our band the day it came out. You're talking about people who are reading and talking about all this other stuff. It filtered into the music. We developed a language for ourselves with each other, to understand each other and make sense of the world. TV on the radio is like a book club. Really nerdy people doing really nerdy shit. Aaron Dessner. That period, like when Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Interpol and the Strokes were exploding, I sometimes think of that as our prehistory. We've always been the tortoise relative to what happened at the beginning of the 2000s. We were spectators and fans of it. Chris Thompson. The National are an interesting case. They were a band for a while before people started paying attention. Matt Berninger. Scott and I came to New York together in the later 90s. We actually took a train from Cincinnati the first time. I don't know why we did that. We thought it would be cool. We were with a couple of our other college friends. We all came up for internships because we were all in design school in Cincinnati. Scott Devendorf. We didn't come here with a big ambition. Matt Berninger. The first place we lived was right around the corner from where the cover of Manhattan was shot, underneath the Queensboro Bridge, where Scott and a bunch of other people slept literally shoulder to shoulder all on the floor. Scott Devendorf. Matt lived in the Gowanus area. It was pretty hilariously rough. Matt Berninger. It was such a cliche. It was a raw, unconverted loft space next to the canal, which would change colors every hour and different smells would come up from it. I lived in one of those places where there were cars burning outside the house and people would dump stuff at the end of the block because it wasn't a through street. In addition to all the burning cars, I think somebody was buying close to overdue milk and rebottling it in this warehouse across the street because once a week, in the middle of the night, they would just pour all the stuff they couldn't use into the street. I'd come out my door and quite literally the streets would be filled with milk, which turned into a lyric. Another time, I came out and there was a cardboard box in the middle of the street, kind of right outside of our door, where all of the rotten milk would be festering, and it was just sitting there by itself in the center of this dead-end street. I wanted to just go to work, but I had to go look. So I opened the box, and there's a headless chicken and a double-ended dildo inside. Aaron Dessner. I ended up in New York because of college. I went to Columbia. Everybody else moved for work. Scott and Matt were both graphic designers, and Brian is a fiction editor. Scott Devendorf. Aaron, Bryce, and my brother Brian had a band before moving here. Matt Berninger. Scott and I were friends. We had a little band when we were at school. And then his brother and the other guys were in a different band. Everybody ended up in New York. Scott and I both had jobs at new media companies, right when the bubble was blooming. Scott Devendorf. Obviously, New York has all the cultural stuff, but also professionally it was one of the hubs for doing design work. Matt Berninger. I had a good job, but I was kind of miserable. I went to Other Music and Kim's all the time. I would buy records and put my headphones on and work on websites with my headphones on. I was trying to escape the anxieties of being a professional, just trying to find a girlfriend. It was the same way that everybody gets into music. It's empathy. It's that you empathize with lost souls. Ed Drost. I came to New York for school. Chris Taylor. I'm from Seattle, but Seattle was really boring. I pretty much wanted to move to the East Coast since I was 9. Matt Berninger. I worked a few blocks up from Mercury Lounge in the Puck Building, and Scott ended up working there too. I would just leave my work every day and go down to Mercury Lounge by myself at like 6:30 or 7, whenever they would open up. I would go early and start drinking Jack and Cokes at the bar. I felt like a total, not a fish out of water, but I was kind of a timid fish, in not such timid water. Mercury Lounge was kind of my mecca. Aaron Dessner. We all grew up in Ohio, so we always sort of felt like outsiders looking in. Matt Berninger. We didn't know what kind of band we were for a long time. Ed Drost. I honestly started making music in my bedroom totally unrelated to what was going on around me. It was actually more due to a depression and a confusion that was personal rather than like, oh my god, there's a cool scene going on. I'm inspired and want to be part of it. Chris Taylor. When Grizzly Bear first formed, in the beginning, Ed wouldn't stand during shows. He sat in a chair, and I was like, oh my god, we're so screwed. Like, this is never going anywhere. The music was so weird and inaccessible. It had nothing to do with Interpol or the Strokes at all. And I was always kind of bummed about that. I was kind of like, shit, I wish we weren't all so weird. Ed Drost. I remember so clearly all of those bands exploding, but I was a spectator. Aaron Dessner. Interpol's rehearsal room in 2000, or maybe it was 2001, was right next to ours. So we would see them in their suits and kind of cower in the hallway and lament our lack of style. Matt Berninger. I remember saying, listen to that band next door. I was blown away by them. We thought, this is where the undiscovered bands come to practice. The people who are really good. Scott Devendorf. We'd stop playing and hear songs off their first record, and we'd be like, oh, great. We got a long way to go. Matt Berninger. A month later, Spin magazine was doing a big feature on them and photographed them in the hallway of this practice space. They had like props and balloons set up, and we had to kind of weave around. They had their suits on, and we had our khaki pants and our work shirts. We were walking through what was probably Interpol's first photo shoot. It felt humiliating, but also motivating. Those fucking guys right next to us? Yesterday they were right next to us and now they're in Spin magazine? That kind of shit happened a lot. Aaron Dessner. Matt was at one of the very first Stroke shows at Don Hills. There were like 30 people and he was raving about it. Matt Berninger. On nights like that, I would just go home to Brooklyn, to a smoke and a six-pack, and just start writing lyrics. Aaron Dessner. We were aware when that Interpol EP came out with NYC on it, and everybody shit their pants. It wasn't intimidating. It was actually just so inspiring. Matt Berninger. We would have liked to be the Strokes, but we were already older and from Cincinnati. We didn't own anything made out of leather, and Converse hurt my back. I was a New Balance guy already, so we couldn't be the Strokes. We knew we couldn't be and shouldn't try. Chris Taylor. All those bands, those people were all on major labels and had very successful careers. Our whole chill, hug-core spirit was a little bit slower paced. And that was definitely more of a Brooklyn thing. Dave Siddick. We had no aspiration of it taking off into the outer world. We were not in that headspace. When everything in New York was blowing up, all of our friends were headlining these giant festivals, and we were still making 9-minute songs about global warming. We were like, oh, we're cool over here, man. And to us, the idea of commercial success was never part of the equation. We weren't really friends with that world.
Eleanor Friedberger. It only seemed weird that bands like The Strokes and Interpol were around at the same time as us when they started doing so well, and I thought they were so bad. I just didn't give a shit about that stuff.
Chapter 46. You could say we had no rules.
Jenny Penny. Interpol were just so crazy good. I'd sometimes just sit by the sound booth and cry. You even knew at the time that it was super special. You knew, this is amazing.
Moby. Maybe a year after the Strokes broke, an old friend of mine from Connecticut, Peter Cadis, played me a record he had just made with some band called Interpol. He said, oh, you might like this, because you like Joy Division. I listened to it and said, this is really good. Then they blew up. Thomas Onorato. Interpol were hometown favorites. Then all of a sudden they had a song on Friends. Do you remember that? I was at a friend's house who was watching the next to last episode of Friends where one of them professed their love to another one.
Sarah Lewitton. Joey to Rachel. I only watched that episode for that moment.
Thomas Onorato.
All of a sudden, this song starts playing, and I'm like, oh my god, this is an Interpol song on Friends. I was so confused. But obviously, it was good for them. Nils Bernstein. After Turn on the Bright Lights came out, everything ramped up. Daniel Kessler. We went back out on the road, in the UK at first. It wasn't like we had a smash radio single, but we had a song getting played at certain times of day on radio stations. Rob Sheffield. Before I saw them live, I was already a fan. I didn't know they were such handsome bastards. I was like, what the fuck? Who are these dudes in the Dolce & Gabbana suits? Can't they leave anything for dorky dudes? They sound like this, and they're hot dudes that are well-dressed? Fuck them. Paul Banks. You know the guy on Pavement playing Letterman in shorts? That's not because he forgot he was doing Letterman that day, you know? All bands think about what they wear. Rob Sheffield. The suits were another anti-90s thing. They were dressing up and doing a show. A show where they would play this super fucking mellow dramatic rock. Art rock. It had none of the stasis and stagnation of art rock, but all the pomposity and pretension. I mean, it cannot be said often enough that they put out their debut album and the first song on it was called Untitled. Thank you very much. This is a historic level of ego. It's like, wow, this is some serious poser shit. And it was part of the appeal of the music. Joe Levy. Interpol is not a New York band for me. They dabble at international sound, and it's why their sound comes from a British band as opposed to one out of New York. Nils Bernstein. I never thought they sounded like Joy Division. I never got that, and I still don't. Mark Spitz. I know firsthand that you don't want to ask Interpol about sounding like Joy Division. They will tell you that they don't sound like Joy Division, and their fans will tell you that they don't sound like Joy Division. But they sound a bit like Joy Division. Paul Banks. What used to be upsetting to me was, if I were to die, my obituary would mention Joy Division. It was like, I've got to just put enough work behind me so that the New York Times is not going to mention this fucking guy Ian Curtis in my fucking orbit. Daniel Kessler. I get the whole, oh, it's a cross between this and that. I get it. The whole post-punk thing. But what's frustrating is it's something you're baptized with. You're wearing it around your neck. Paul Banks. It just feels dismissive. But I also look at it as boo-hoo. The world didn't give you a fucking blowjob for the first thing you did. People focus a lot on the superficial aspects of the band, like fashion and shit. And I don't want to even perpetuate that thing by talking about my bitterness. Rob Sheffield. Boy, they were good. They were really good. Sam Fogarino. I think a lot of it, the increase in partying, had to do with the bus. It symbolized upward movement. We weren't in a van anymore. That meant the venues were getting a little bit bigger, and people were really catching on. It wasn't for nothing. We didn't just decide, well, let's get a bus and go into debt. Business-wise, it all made sense on paper. And that's when I started noticing that I didn't have to move a muscle. It became easier to meet people. The party would just gravitate toward us.
Jenny Penny. Fans would always invite them over to a house or one of their hotel rooms. The most fun was when we went to the Midwest and someone would invite us to some huge house in the middle of nowhere and give you any drugs you wanted, and beer. There was this girl who hung around, Alexis, who we all agreed was the most insane person on the entire planet. One time, we were in this car on the way to some party at someone's house in San Diego, and when we got there, she goes, "Oh my God, Jenny, I did something really bad. I peed my pants." So we go to this house party, and she pushed me into this room and locked the door and went through some girl's closet. She pulled out a jean skirt, put her pee-soaked pants in a plastic bag, put on the girl's jean skirt, and we went to the party.
Daniel Kessler. I guess you could say we had no rules. Paul Banks. Carlos and I were the guys who partied. Daniel was always a little bit more measured. Daniel Kessler. They had a sort of libertine way about them. Self-preservation was not on their agenda. They were out for what does the night have to offer,
I didn't pursue debauchery quite like they did. But while we were touring, I had a lot of fun. It was a really nice time meeting people, going out, touring the world, traveling, going to this bar and that bar, getting drunk. Sam Fogarino, I just remember getting on that bus and thinking this could end tomorrow. I'm just going to savor this in every possible way. Anthony Rossomando, for every scene, there's always someone who is creative, who's not a musician or player, who's creating an atmosphere where people come together and get high and listen to great music and have really long, involved discussions that they don't remember about really personal things. For this scene, Jason Barron was that guy. Paul Banks. Jason photographed Interpol in London. Jason Barron. It was right before the album came out. Interpol was the first band I ever shot, for NME. Paul Banks. Carlos and Jason hit it off, and then I would tag along with those guys. Jason just knew how to party. Jason Barron. We became friends very quickly. We had a lot in common.
Sarah Lewitton. I'm trying to think how I first met Jason. There was a hotel room, Interpol was there, he was friends with Carlos. Let's be clear, a lot of people met because of cocaine.
Paul Banks. Then he moved to New York and opened the Dark Room, the biggest and most amazing party scene of that era. He single-handedly made that happen.
Jenny Penny. After Dark Room opened, that's all it was, just Dark Room all the time.
Jason Barron. I came over to New York for a friend's wedding with a carry-on piece of luggage and just stayed. When anyone from New York would go overseas, they'd be the last people standing. So all over the world, the thought was, those people are crazy. Let's go to their city. And when we go to their city, we're going to be crazy too. When people would come to New York from anywhere else in the world, I was kind of the point man if you wanted to get in trouble. I was an excuse for a lot of breakups. Anthony Rossomando. The stories I have from the Dark Room with Jason? Fuck. It was called the Dark Room, and darkness descended, my friend.
Jenny Penny. You'd go every night. You'd get a drink upstairs, a double of something, and go straight to the basement and just see who showed up. Jason also lived upstairs, so there was that.
Jason Barron. You develop a lot of new friends really fast in New York. I guess there's an international degenerate underground. Anthony Rossomando. Jason was an excellent host and the grand wizard of enablers. He was constantly just like, let's do this. Take this upstairs. What about these two? Yeah, she's hot. Jason Barron. Honestly, I could abstain from sex for like 10 years and still be proud.
Sarah Lewitton. We all lost years of our life in that place.
Anthony Rossomando. It was like swimming in a pool of cocaine. It was just diving into a sea of white. Jason Barron. One of the funniest ones is that Australian band, Jet. I get a phone call from one of them, and they're like, have you seen our singer? I'm like, no. They're like, he's in your bar. I go downstairs, and this dude is just chilling there. They're supposed to be in D.C. opening up for Oasis in 15 minutes. He's like, what's up, bro? Anthony Rossomando. Yes, it was dirty. But you'd also have emotional heart-to-hearts in there with people that you'd only see in that room. I only saw Paul Banks there. I think Paul lived under Jason's couch. I also think that Paul had clean sweaters waiting for him there.
Jenny Penny. Paul always wore extra layers.
Anthony Rossomando. I looked awful. I was dirty. I had shit under my nails. But Paul... he'd have this sweater tied around his neck like fucking James Spader. James Spader of the music scene. Paul Banks. Anthony who? Anthony Rossomando. It was more wild than other bars. At those other places, you still had to go to the bathroom to take drugs, or the kitchen, the weird room. The dark room was more community-based. No one was too possessive about their drugs. There was an abundance. Jason Barron. The first week we were open, the Libertines had the after-party for their Bowery show at Dark Room. I gave those dudes a couple of free beers, and they didn't leave for a week.
Jenny Penny. I'd come home at 10 a.m. every day. I would just go home and take whatever sleeping pills someone had given me. I'd put on a movie in my bedroom and try to sleep. I had a blanket nailed to my wall to block out any sunlight, and my roommate was always leaving for work or something.
Paul Banks. I'd wake up around 2, or when I'm really rolling, 5 p.m., 6 p.m. Coffee, then maybe Bloody Marys before coffee or right after coffee, then beers in the early afternoon, and then maybe pool after dinner. Then, from playing pool, Whiskey Ward to Max Fish for more pool, and then Dark Room until close, and after that, Jason's place until 6, when I would try and get back to my girlfriend at what I thought was a respectable hour, rather than go to the full 11 a.m. Anthony Rossomando. I remember sharing sunglasses with Paul a couple of times. Somebody was keeping some spare cheap sunglasses around. Talk about being prepared for the inevitable. Paul Banks. Jason and I became close, close friends. I love spending time with him. Jason Barron. Me and Paul would be hanging out, watching Saturday Night Live, and he'd be like, yeah, I like that band. And 20 minutes later, that band would show up at the bar. Paul Banks. I was like a fixture in his apartment from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. Jason Barron. Then there was Bushy. Paul Banks. Bushy is amazing. He was a coke dealer who would beat people up and play street ball and wear awesome sneakers. He was so fashion forward. He would be wearing neon windbreakers. He was like a male counterpart of MIA, but way earlier. That's how ahead he was in terms of fashion. Jason Barron. Paul and I would be at my place playing chess, and I'd go knock on Bushy's door just to see what he was up to. Bushy would open the door buck naked. Just this little white dude, buck naked, with 18 girls behind him, piles of drugs everywhere, and he'd be like, you want some? Paul Banks. I remember one day, when he came down from his apartment upstairs to supply the party at Jason's, wearing just sneakers and a t-shirt. He was bending over, you know, balls out, and I don't think he was aware that he had no pants on. He was just gone.
Karen Ruttner. There was a story that went around that Axl Rose showed up in the apartment one night.
Jason Barron. Yeah, he did. This was pre-Kitsch Cool Again, Axl. This is Axl with cornrows, before Chinese democracy. I was hanging out, I think Paul had just left, and I was just sitting there with some people when someone's like, I'm bringing Axl by. I'm like, fucking all right. And the dude came by. He had the tight curls. He was wearing hip-hop clothes. He kept going, yo, you want to hear the CD? Talking about Chinese democracy. I convinced him my CD player didn't work. He was the last one out, shaking beers in my apartment. Paul Banks. I always had an inclination toward that world. When you go out and it's late at night, you're seeing something that's more real. You're seeing people loosened up, loose around the edges. And real crazy shit can happen. People get into real fights and people get fucked up. At that age, I felt my only way of accessing real things was in a dark room late at night where drugs are involved. David Cross. It's important to point out that this wasn't all some romanticized hellish rabbit hole of shit that we went down. It was never a plan. It was more that you'd be out, you'd find yourself at the dark room, then you'd be upstairs, and then whatever. Those nights would happen. You'd go see a band, and you know the people who hang around bands, the shady people. You end up there because you're bored, and why the fuck not? You're in New York fucking city, and you're a celebrity. I'm not proud of it. That's just what the life was. Chapter 47. Strokes versus Stripes. Dean Wareham. I remember doing interviews around this time, and everyone was just like, is it true that the Strokes and White Stripes have saved rock and roll, and New York is the place again? It was like, I guess so. Ryan Adams.
When the Strokes and the White Stripes played Radio City, everybody did kind of go, "This is it. This means we did it." Ben Blackwell. The Strokes' White Stripes Radio City gig was August of 2002. Ryan Gentles. We did those shows together, one at Irving Plaza and one in Radio City, and two in Detroit. It was Julian's idea. Julian and Jack had talked about it. They said they wanted to do a tour, and Julian said, "Let's just do a show in your town and a show in our town." And Jack said, "Let's do a small one and a big one." And we split everything 50-50. That created a friendship. Jack White. Julian and I got along well. Russell Warby. I'd made sure they met. We took Jack to a show that the Strokes played in Leeds. They had been really blissfully unaware of each other. I can remember telling the Strokes about the White Stripes, and they didn't know of them. And the White Stripes did not know the Strokes personally, but Meg liked the Strokes' record. Jack White. In England, I was very interested in the Strokes, and very disinterested in what I felt were tabloidy magazines trying to figure out how to make us into rivals. I was not interested in that nonsense at all. I liked their band very much. Russell Warby. So I made sure they met, because it can be quite competitive, you know. I wanted it to be a situation where they could play together. Jack White. At an early point, Nick Valencia and I stayed at the same hotel in London, and we got to sit and talk. He brought up that we were sort of in the same boat over there in London with all the new attention. I agreed, and Meg and I took a train to Leeds to see them play. I loved their show, but it was the first time I saw a band not do an encore on purpose, and I remember thinking that might not be a good showmanship idea. Who knows? The show was great. Ben Blackwell. The Detroit shows were first. Jack White. Julian stayed at my house and slept in my childhood bedroom, even wore my pajamas. He came into my room in the middle of the night thinking it was the bathroom, and we laughed. He had a broken ankle or something, though, so it was hard getting into our local Coney Island in the morning for breakfast with his crutches. Ryan Adams. I was at those shows at Radio City. I remember standing on the side of the stage right before Jack walked on to play New York City Cops. Beck was standing there, too, because they're friends. Julian had a broken leg, so that was a bummer for him, but he still totally kicked ass. Ben Blackwell. After one of the New York shows, we all ended up at that bar across the street from Manitoba's, 7B. Ryan Adams. Everybody went downtown in the back of a pickup truck. I remember thinking someone is going to die, because everyone was pretty wasted. Ben Blackwell. This is the power that the Strokes had in New York City at that time. We're walking into 7B, and Fab is just like, "Hey man, my buddy doesn't have his ID, but he's cool. I totally vouch for him." And the guy just waved me in. So I was like, "Wow, these guys fucking own this city, don't they?" Nick Valencia. Okay, but the White Stripes were huge. They'd put out White Blood Cells and they were on MTV. They were really big. Harmar Superstar. It was all about the Lego video. Fell in love with a girl. Jack White. I have 20 or so nieces and nephews, and I remember them wanting to watch that Lego video a second and third time, which shocked me. I couldn't believe young kids wanted to experience something Meg and I had made. The childish theme was one we revolved around a lot, so that was a magical moment to see it come full circle. Rob Sheffield. It was June 2001 when I saw the White Stripes for the first time. I saw them with Jenny Eliscue, of course. Jenny was just an absolutely selfless booster, and she was never wrong. It was at Bowery, and it was just the two of them. They did not stop between songs, and they were not fucking around. They played fast and kept doing it without sort of hemming and hawing. And there was that intensity and that enthusiasm. It's weird how much of it just comes down to that word, enthusiasm. Like, these are not like stare at the floor and diddle and tune up and make grumpy faces at the sound guy bands. I get why musicians have to do that, but I fucking hate it. It was mid-June,
a Sunday evening show that felt like an afternoon matinee because the sun was still up when we went in. 90% of the people at the show were there because of Jenny. I remember they did both Jolene and Stop Breaking Down, and I was stunned they had the chutzpah to do these sacred songs, and even more stunned they had something new to tell me about them. They did all these songs from the White Blood Cells album, which hadn't come out yet, so none of us had heard them before. I thought they were doing a cover of The Clash's Sound of the Sinners, but it turned out to be Hotel Yorba. If I recall correctly, they ended with the Marlene Dietrich one. Man, that's a show I'll never forget. Mark Spitz. The White Stripes' publicist, Chloe Walsh, was just so persistent, to her credit. No one was writing about them. They'd already put out the Destel album, which was also amazing, but no one knew that yet. Rob Sheffield. White Blood Cells had just come out and was so great, but it was funny. I hadn't heard the first two. Mark Spitz. So Chloe was trying to get them some mainstream love. She kept harassing me to listen to this record, White Blood something. I played it once and I didn't hear it. Rob Sheffield. At that show, someone just climbed on stage and sang You're Pretty Good Looking for a Girl. This guy kept yelling for it and like Jack was like, I don't feel like doing that one. So he just climbed up on stage. He was wearing a muscle shirt and a red bandana and mascara, looking like Paul Stanley trick-or-treating, and was no spring chicken either, and I thought this guy must be famous or in a 70s band, or at least a friend of Jack's. But no, he was just a really big fan who really wanted to hear that song. The next day, I walked up to Rocket Scientist in the West Village to buy any White Stripes albums they had. The guy said, "Funny you should ask. A lot of people have been coming in and asking for those today. They're all sold out." I bought the last White Stripes record he had in the store, which was a CD copy of the debut, and I was glad to get it. Every other record of theirs sold out that morning. Mark Spitz. Chloe kept after me, and I was like, all right, here, I'll listen to this fucking album one more time. So one morning, it was probably around 1 p.m, and I was having breakfast, which would probably be a line of cocaine, 4 Camel cigarettes and a large coffee, and maybe a chocolate donut. And something clicked when he said, "Said it once before, but it bears repeating now." And it was like, wait a minute, that's kind of great. And I played it again, and then the riff got me, and just spun my head around like a blender. That riff was so good and fast and dirty, and you could actually see someone in your mind playing it. Whereas, like, you couldn't really see Sugar Ray making their records in your mind. They didn't sound like people made them. They sounded like they hired people to make them. So I went back, and I listened to the whole record. And then I heard, like, Dead Leaves in the Dirty Ground, Hotel Yorba, and I felt a palpable shame. It would be easy for me to say, yeah, I was into it from the jump. But I was in a bad, cynical place, because it was my job to write about Mark McGrath. Rob Sheffield. The most popular band in the 90s was Pearl Jam, and lots of people were wondering where the bands like them were. The guys that are not trying to do a mega angsty theatrical production about their parents and their upbringing and their anger management issues. Just dudes with guitars that want to rock. I have a friend who was a janitor, and I would pass promos on to him sometimes. He was a biker guy, and he was like, "I like Pearl Jam. Why the fuck didn't those guys make another record?" And I'd say, "Actually, dude, they made another record last year, and the year before that, and you never heard it because nobody cared. They're making lots of records. Like they're about to put out 72 live albums this week." But I remember I said to him, "I finally got one for you. The White Stripes." They were the only band I told him about where he was like, yes. Even if you were not invested in the idea of cool or invested in the idea of New York or even interested in the idea of newness, then you could still rock.
Jenny Eliscu. The first time I saw the White Stripes, I went to see Slater Kinney and I got there early and they were opening up. It reminded me of Royal Trucks, first and foremost, except Royal Trucks were always a little too scuzzy and sleazy. They had that album cover of a toilet full of poop, which kind of bummed me out. Like, I get it, but I needed something a little bit cuter and more twee in a way. Not that the White Stripes are twee, but that early stuff. Even some of the music on Distill has more of that classic indie rock Kinksy thing. So I was just like, who the fuck are these idiots? I mean, it was like really scrappy, and Meg White was a terrible